KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump tells world leaders, make your products in America or pay tariffs. We'll hear if it's just a bargaining tactic or the start of a serious world economic plan for the U.S. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family reached a new settlement to resolve thousands of lawsuits over OxyContin. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez, it's worth more than $7 billion, but it does not give them immunity over future opioid lawsuits. Also, how an artist in Los Angeles is offering to draw the homes of people who lost them in the fires. And on StoryCorps, the importance of knowing and being yourself. It's Friday, January 24th, the first American woman to win the all-around gold in Olympic gymnastics. Mary Lou Retton is 57 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Vice President Vance is scheduled to address the annual March for Life today in Washington, D.C. As NPR's Sarah McCammon reports, this year's gathering of anti-abortion activists comes at a time when conservatives control the White House, Congress, and hold a majority in the Supreme Court.
President Trump has bragged about his role in choosing Supreme Court justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. But since then, he's offered mixed messages about whether he'd support new federal restrictions, as some activists are calling for. Trump's vice president, J.D. Vance, is set to address the march in person, his first public appearance since the inauguration. Here's Vance at the Ohio March for Life in 2023.
For the millions of babies as yet unborn in this country, we are going to fight for you every step of the way. There are many steps to take it. I'll be right there walking with you.
House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune are also scheduled to speak. Sarah McCammon, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration says federal immigration officers have arrested hundreds of people they say are criminals who are illegally in the U.S. The White House says hundreds of people have now been deported by military aircraft. One raid yesterday was in Newark, New Jersey. Newark's mayor, Ross Baraka, says federal agents detained American citizens in the raid. He says that includes a U.S. military veteran. Mayor Baraka says people are being unlawfully terrorized. A federal judge in Washington state has temporarily blocked Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship. The president is seeking to eliminate that right for some Americans. The federal judge says that is blatantly unconstitutional. Trump says that ruling will be challenged.
Obviously, we'll appeal it. They put it before a certain judge in Seattle, I guess, right? There's no surprises with that judge.
Many states and cities are suing President Trump, saying the president does not have the right to overturn the U.S. Constitution. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a modest uptick in home sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 150 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes rose just over 2% in December, and the average selling price topped $404,000. Even with the modest increase at the end of the year, 2024 saw the lowest level of home sales in nearly three decades. Sales have been weighed down by a shortage of homes on the market and high interest rates. Freddie Mac says the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is now just under 7%, down slightly from a week ago. President Trump told business leaders in Davos yesterday he will, quote, demand lower interest rates. Bond markets have generally pushed rates higher since Trump's election, however, and the Federal Reserve is expected to hold rates steady when policymakers meet next week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Four Israeli female hostages are expected to be released this weekend in exchange for about 200 Palestinian prisoners. This is part of the Gaza ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. The names of the hostages, including some soldiers, are expected to be released soon. Crime rates continue to fall in many parts of the U.S. New data from a sample of 40 cities offer early insight into possible national trends. NPR's Meg Anderson has more.
Researchers looked at more than a dozen offenses, including homicide, sexual assault, robbery, motor vehicle theft, and burglaries. Shoplifting was the only one that increased in 2024 compared to the year before, by around 14%. Ernesto Lopez, a senior research specialist at the Council on Criminal Justice, says shoplifting likely has increased, but preventing it has also become an intense focus of both police and retailers.
So that really suggests that it's possible there's an increase in reporting and an increase in detection.
The study found violent crime, on the other hand, fell dramatically. Most of those crime rates are now at or below their pre-pandemic levels. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Aircraft maker Boeing says it lost a lot of money at the end of last year, more than $3.5 billion between October and December. Part of that is because of the long machinist strike against Boeing. And Boeing's Starliner program is troubled. Two astronauts who flew into space last year are still stuck there. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, the Oscar for the Best Original Song goes to... we don't know yet, but we'll hear the nominees.
But we're going to begin with President Trump's address to the annual World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland on Thursday. Here's the pitch he made on live video via satellite to more than 1,000 global political and business leaders.
Come make your product in America, and we will give you among the lowest taxes of any nation on earth.
Or?
Then very simply, you will have to pay a tariff, differing amounts, but a tariff which will direct hundreds of billions of dollars and even trillions of dollars into our treasury to strengthen our economy and pay down debt.
To hear more about this and some of the other economic plans the president talked about, I'm joined now by David Wessel. He is the director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. That's a nonpartisan think tank based in Washington, D.C. It's focused on policy and governance. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Michelle.
Okay, so I called what Trump talked about economic plans, but are they? Are they plans or are they bargaining tactics?
That's the right question, and we don't know the answer. I mean, it's really important to watch what President Trump actually does, not only what he says, because he likes to say a lot of things that are pretty provocative. He's basically offering foreign companies a carrot and a stick. The stick is the tariffs, but we don't know exactly how he'd target them or what exceptions he'd make. Tariffs, of course, are taxes on imports, some of which would be passed on to consumers in higher prices. I mean, does he really want to put tariffs on the oil we import from Canada, for instance? And we don't know also how our trading partners would respond, but they've threatened to retaliate, which would hurt our exporters. On the carrot side, he's talking about cutting the corporate tax rate from 21% to 15%. That's something that he can only do with Congress's consent, and it's really expensive. If it's really narrowly targeted, it's still $200 billion over 10 years, and that's on top of the cost of extending the individual tax cuts, which expire at the end of this year.
So, you know, you've been in Davos in the past, David. Did this speech differ from what you might usually hear there?
It does. I mean, this was an America First speech. It sounded more like he was campaigning in Pittsburgh or Las Vegas than reassuring allies and adversaries in other countries. I mean, listening to him, you'd never know that the U.S. actually economy was pretty strong. And you'd think that he had the power to order people to do other things, to tell OPEC to bring down oil prices, to tell Europe to spend more on defense. And what struck me was the contrast to the speech given by the Chinese vice premier, who talked about the universal and beneficial, inclusive economic globalization. Trade wars have no winners, he said. Now, China isn't exactly playing by the rules, but I suspect the Chinese are looking at what Trump is doing and saying he's putting cracks in the Western alliance and they're going to go right through them.
And I do have to say that some of the things he said just simply aren't true. Like Canada, for example, is not running a $200 billion trade surplus with the U.S. I think it's more like
$45 billion.
Right. Okay, so yeah. There's that. All right. Energy figures prominently in a lot of Trump's speeches, including yesterday's. He talked about increasing oil production, even coal. Could you say more about what his priorities and point of view are in this area?
Well, his point of view is that we should just produce more oil and gas. He doesn't care about climate change. He says that increased production of oil and gas will lower prices in the U.S., and that'll help fight inflation. But actually, in the past year, energy prices have been falling. It's other things driving inflation. And the U.S. is producing more oil now than it did has before, 20% more than when he left office. But producing oil, he seems to think that's the magic elixir. And he's going to waive permits to the extent he can. And one thing's interesting is if he really does push down the price of oil, that, of course, reduces the incentive for American producers to drill.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Okay, one more thing briefly. The president drew a connection between lower oil prices and interest rates. How does that work?
Well, look, the president did say if inflation comes down, interest rates will tend to move down. That's true. But he said he could demand interest rates come down. And that's just not something he has the power to do. The bond market has pushed up long-term interest rates, and the Fed has signaled it's not going to rush because they're worried about his plans.
That is David Wessel with the Brookings Institution. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
State attorneys general have reached a new opioid settlement with Purdue Pharma. That's the company that makes OxyContin. The tentative deal is worth more than $7 billion and includes the company's owners, members of the Sackler family. However, it does not give them immunity from future opioid lawsuits, as the family had hoped. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann joins us. So, Brian, an earlier deal approved by a federal bankruptcy court did grant the Sacklers immunity from opioid lawsuits. What happened here?
Yeah, that agreement was really controversial, and it was eventually shot down last year by the U.S. Supreme Court. The justices ruled U.S. law just doesn't give bankruptcy courts the power to block lawsuits in the way the Sacklers wanted. That forced everyone back to the negotiating table. Under this new deal, the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma actually agreed to pay more, about $500 million more than under the previous deal, without getting that big firewall against future lawsuits.
So why would they sign off then?
Yeah, NPR asked the Sacklers for a statement about that. We haven't heard back. What we know is this agreement would settle all lawsuits against Purdue Pharma, and it would prevent most future lawsuits against the Sacklers. Here's what's interesting. The deal also sets aside up to $800 million for a legal fund that the Sacklers could use in the future if they're sued. And what that means, A, is the cost of any future opioid litigation against the Sacklers would be paid for not by the family, but out of this opioid settlement fund. So they're not getting immunity from future lawsuits, but the Sacklers are still going to walk away with a lot of financial protection.
Okay, this story goes way back. So remind us why there's been so much of a focus on this company and this family.
Yeah, the opioid crisis, we all know it's been raging for a long time, started in the 90s, killed millions of Americans, really ravaged communities. And public health experts and government officials say it all began with this company, Purdue Pharma. The company falsely marketed this pain medication, OxyContin, as less addictive, less dangerous. In a statement yesterday, Connecticut's Attorney General Scott Tong accused the Sacklers of igniting one of the most devastating public health crises in American history. The Sacklers themselves have never been charged with any crime, but their company did eventually plead guilty to federal charges twice for deceptive marketing, while federal prescribing rules for pain pills have now been tightened. We're still caught up in this wider opioid crisis where drugs like OxyContin have given way to heroin and fentanyl.
Is this settlement money, though, expected to help ease the crisis?
You know, state attorneys general who negotiated this deal say, yes, if the courts sign off, it will help. New York's state attorney general, Letitia James, said in a statement that this massive influx of funds will bring resources to communities so they can heal. Once finalized, this $7.4 billion would come on top of roughly $50 billion in opioid settlement cash already agreed to by other big companies that also got involved in the opioid pain pill business.
Yeah, that's a lot of corporate settlement money you talked about there. I mean, is it being well spent?
Yeah, there's a debate underway about that. Critics say a lot of that money is being diverted, spent by local and state governments on things like law enforcement. But supporters of these deals say a lot of the money is starting to flow to pay for addiction treatment, counseling, and housing. Public health experts say those resources might be one of the reasons drug overdose deaths from fentanyl are finally dropping.
NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann. Brian, thanks.
Thank you.
We're used to seeing the Academy Award nominees for Best Original Song performed live on Oscars night. And several of the top 2025 contenders are movies built around big musical performances, including Amelia Perez, Wicked, and A Complete Unknown.
Once upon a time, you're just so fine. Through the bumps of dime in your prime.
But before the nominations came out yesterday, the Academy revealed that won't happen this year. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
It's not the first time the Oscars have left performances of the Best Original Song nominees out of the pre-show or ceremony. The last time was in 2012. And producers often experiment with which songs make it into the telecast and who performs them. This year, the Academy's president, Janet Yang, and CEO Bill Kramer announced that presentation for Best Songs will focus on personal reflections from the songwriting teams instead of live performances. That's Mi Camino, one of the two nominees from the musical thriller Emilia Perez. That film's music and lyrics are by composer Clément Ducol, singer-songwriter Camille, and director Jacques Audiard. There's also El Mal, as performed by Zoe Saldana. The three other nominees honor Grammy and Film Academy darlings, like The Journey, a song penned by Diane Warren and performed by her for the movie The 6888.
It's the journey, it's the getting there to where you're going to.
It's Warren's 16th Best Original Song nomination, though she's never won before. There's also Like a Bird from the film Sing Sing, a song by Abraham Alexander, and Black Puma's guitarist, Adrian Quesada. And the Elton John documentary, Never Too Late, got a nod for its titular song. Music and lyrics by two-time Oscar winner Sir Elton John, as well as Brandi Carlile, Andrew Watt, and Bernie Taupin.
Was never too late to go shoot out the moon.
Unless the Academy changes course, which has happened before, we will see one of these songs win an Oscar, but we won't see it live. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
Later today on All Things Considered, whether it's the nominations or the winners themselves, Oscar voters can get it very, very wrong. We talk Oscar blunders, past and present. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station.
Don't the years make jokes of all of us? Let the whole century slide.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember painter and filmmaker David Lynch, who made the cult film Eraserhead, the film version of The Elephant Man, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, and the TV series Twin Peaks. We'll hear his 1994 interview and interviews with those who worked with him, including Isabella Rossellini and Nicolas Cage. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Prominent climate activists in the United States were targeted several years ago in a global hacking campaign.
The Justice Department is trying to extradite someone it says is a key player in the story.
NPR's Michael Copley is in London covering the latest developments. So, Michael, what took you to London?
I've been here for an extradition hearing. It's for an Israeli private investigator who's accused by the U.S. of orchestrating a hacking operation against American climate activists. The private eye's name is Amit Forlett. He was arrested earlier this year at London's Heathrow Airport. And we should say at the top, Forlett has previously denied ordering or paying for hacking.
All right, so a private investigator. Do we know who he was allegedly working for?
So a British lawyer representing the U.S. Justice Department said Forlett was allegedly working for an unnamed public affairs firm based in Washington, D.C., and that that firm was allegedly representing one of the world's biggest oil and gas companies based in Texas, again unnamed. The lawyer said the oil and gas company wanted to discredit activists connected to climate change litigation.
So the private eye was allegedly working for this public affairs company, which in turn was allegedly working for a big oil and gas company.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, but the U.S. government hasn't named the companies.
No, it hasn't. We did hear from one of Forlett's lawyers this week. She said in court that the U.S. is trying to prosecute Forlett for leading a hacking operation that was allegedly commissioned by a public affairs firm called DCI Group that was representing ExxonMobil. The Justice Department didn't respond to a message seeking comment. It hasn't accused Exxon or DCI of wrongdoing. Exxon and DCI declined to comment on being mentioned in court before the hearing in London. Both said in emails to NPR that they haven't been involved in hacking.
Why did you contact those companies before they were mentioned in court in London?
So there have been media reports stating that the U.S. has investigated DCI as part of its hacking probe. Before the London hearings, a source familiar with the probe confirmed to NPR that the U.S. has investigated DCI's possible role in the hacking. The source wasn't authorized to speak publicly. NPR hasn't found what, if any, links the Justice Department thought DCI may have had with the hacking campaign, and we have not found any indications that the Justice Department investigated ExxonMobil.
So it sounds like the government and journalists have been pursuing this hacking investigation for a while.
Yeah, so the government investigation became public in 2019. A business associate of Forlett's was arrested in the U.S. He eventually pleaded guilty to hacking-related charges, and in 2023, a federal judge sentenced him to more than 6 years in prison. In that case, federal prosecutors said stolen information was leaked to the media and that ExxonMobil's lawyers used the media coverage to try to fight state climate investigations. Federal prosecutors did not accuse ExxonMobil of any wrongdoing. The company said at the time that it had not been involved in hacking.
Okay, so where do things go from here?
I mean, you know, it's been years since the hacking allegedly started, but the victims say it's critical for the U.S. to find out who ordered it. Matt Powell is one of the victims and an environmental lawyer. He says finding out what happened is important for punishing whoever was ultimately responsible.
And for the purposes of deterrence, so that this is not done again. And deterrence gets to these big issues of, you know, living in a free society. If we have a lot of hacking, then we're not going to live in a very free society because people are going to be afraid to speak out.
For now, we're waiting to see if the UK extradites Forlett. Another extradition hearing is expected in the coming weeks.
All right, that's NPR's Michael Copley from the Climate Desk. Michael, thanks.
Thanks, A.
It is Friday, and that means it is time for StoryCorps. This week, a conversation from the Brightness in Black Project, sharing stories of Black love, joy, and triumphs. 16-year-old Tamar Anderson Henry has autism. She came to StoryCorps with her mother, Soleil Henry, to talk about the importance of knowing and being yourself.
I'll never forget the first time you tried violin. They called me back in that room within 20 minutes, and you were playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Well, music helped me be myself because it is my natural talent.
Yes, you have talent. You have an amazing gift. You have gifts. And those gifts, they're a part of you, but they don't make you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I've always kept you sheltered because, yeah, you're high functioning, but just hearing that word autism, it was scary at first. But one thing I love is that you embrace it. And I've heard you say to people, I have autism, you know, I think a little differently. But it was a fear of mine that you wouldn't be proud because of it.
To be honest, I don't really care what people say because people are going to judge you either way. It's not going to stop. And I just ignore it and just keep moving on with life or my headphones because my headphones are like the key to my ears. It helps me.
Does it help keep the music in, drown the people out, or both?
Both.
Both. Both. Does it help drawing your mom out too?
Well, you put it to that way.
I know it does. But that's you, though. You know, you've learned how to cope in this hard thing called life. I know you say it's hard being a teenager.
It is.
An adult is harder, baby, and it comes with a lot more ups and downs. There's going to be triumphs and disappointments, unfortunately. But I don't have to speak up for you and tell people who you are. You do that best for yourself. What I wanted for you is what you're growing up to be. You're that light. Be happy, be healthy. Just be you, though. What do you think?
Love it.
Soleil Henry and her daughter, Tamar Anderson Henry, for StoryCorps in Charlotte, North Carolina. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com.
This is NPR News.
In 2022, at a rave in Prague, a new feeling washed over FKA Twigs.
It's pure presence. It's a moment of nothingness. This egoless presence filled with tingling clarity.
She called the feeling Eusexua, which is also the name of her new album. I'm Juana Summers. We'll sit down with FKA Twigs on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is heading to Western North Carolina this morning. In Asheville, Trump will be getting an update on recovery efforts 4 months after Hurricane Helene's torrential rains caused widespread flooding and destruction. The storm came ashore along Florida's Gulf Coast in late September, leaving more than 200 people dead and billions of dollars worth of damage. Later, the president will head to Southern California, where crews are still trying to put out wildfires near Los Angeles and San Diego. NPR's Deepa Shivaram says Trump is threatening to withhold federal disaster aid to California unless the state changes its water policies.
Trump sees it as an opportunity for political leverage. He's trying to build support in Congress for some of his legislative priorities, like tax cuts and government spending measures, and having support from some Democrats who want the wildfire aid passed might make that easier.
Before boarding Marine One, President Trump voiced support for Pete Hegseth, his nominee to lead the Pentagon. He's expected to be narrowly confirmed by the Senate today, with two Republican senators announcing they will vote against Hegseth, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine.
I was very surprised that Collins and Murkowski would do that.
That's the president speaking outside the White House. This is NPR News. The Senate has confirmed John Ratcliffe to serve as CIA director. The vote was 74 to 25, with many Democratic senators joining Republicans to support Ratcliffe. He's a former GOP congressman from Texas who served as the director of national intelligence during Trump's first term in office. Vail Resorts is facing more labor issues. A union representing ski lift operators at Crested Butte in Colorado has voted to authorize a strike, as NPR's Kirk Sigler reports.
Lift maintenance workers at Crested Butte, which Vail Resorts bought in 2018, unionized 2 years ago, and say for the past year they've been asking for a cost of living raise. The union says it's experienced a 50% turnover and says Vail isn't paying enough for employees to afford to live in Colorado's pricey Gunnison Valley. In a statement, Vail says its wages are fair for all employees and the negotiations with the 12-member union are making progress. But this is the latest salvo in a winter marked by slim snowfall and significant labor disputes. At Vail's Park City Resort, the Ski Patrol Union went on strike for nearly 2 weeks, causing stock prices to slump after a blizzard of customer complaints. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
Sales of existing homes in the U.S. fell in 2024 to their lowest level in almost 30 years. The National Association of Realtors cites in part elevated mortgage rates. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Trump administration has nixed DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion programs across federal government.
These programs were part of a civil rights movement stretching back decades, but the president has called these efforts, quote, dangerous, demeaning, or immoral, unquote. And he's also targeting efforts to investigate extremism in the military's ranks.
NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman joins us now to discuss. So Tom, first off, just start off with the Defense Department's DEI programs. What are they?
Well, these programs have been seen as pretty effective in bringing more women and minorities into the ranks at all levels. President Biden chose the first woman, Admiral Lisa Franchetti, to run the Navy, as well as the first Black Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin. But Donald Trump and his Defense Secretary nominee, Pete Hegseth, have dismissed these programs as woke and divisive. Another thing they question is extremist activity. My colleague Lauren Hodges and I talked about all this in our recent podcast, A Good Guy. It focused on an active duty Marine Sergeant Josh Abate, who was in the Capitol on January 6th and pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor. Abate told the court in a written statement that he was wrong about the election being stolen. And by the way, a Marine panel voted to keep him in, and he's still on active duty.
Now, so what does that say then about understanding extremism in the military?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that about 1 in 5 of those who were arrested for January 6 activities had military backgrounds, nearly all veterans. Now, Pentagon officials have long insisted that they don't have an extremism problem, that the numbers are small. But, you know, they really don't know because they've never collected data. And the services within the last several months said they would collect such data, and they outlined prohibitive behavior, such as joining militia groups, raising money for them, or attending rallies for extremist groups.
So all this now brings us to Pete Hegseth. That's President Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense. What has he said about all this?
Well, he has been very outspoken, not only about his opposition to DEI programs, but also efforts to better understand whether the Pentagon and the military services have an extremism problem. Here he is at his confirmation hearing when he was asked about that by Republican Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota. Let's listen.
Things like focusing on extremism, Senator, have created a climate inside our ranks that feel political when it hasn't ever been political. Those are the types of things that are going to change.
Now, officials who worked on these anti-extremist efforts say, no, it's not political. It's not what politician you support or even ideas you might have. It's all about action. Again, like joining the militia groups, taking part in racist or anti-government rallies, but clearly all these efforts to collect data on extremism will end.
All right, so Hegseth will get rid of DEI programs, those extremist fact-finding programs. What else do we expect from him should the Senate confirm him?
Well, we could see him making some personnel changes, maybe removing military leaders he believes got the job not based on merit, but because of their gender or race. There is concern with people I talk with in the Pentagon, in the Office of Corps. At this point, we'll just have to wait and see.
All right, that's NPR's Tom Bowman. Tom, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
When Los Angeles artist Asher Bingham learned the house of a friend was one of the 16,000 structures destroyed by the LA area wildfires, she didn't know what to say that could be helpful. So she found another way to respond. Here's KCRW's Megan Jamerson.
Last week, 20 drawings of houses covered Asher Bingham's coffee table.
It's a beautiful and very sad pile.
All of these homes were destroyed by the Los Angeles wildfires. Bingham is a portrait artist, and in the wake of the devastation, she started to draw keepsakes for people of what their houses used to look like. Inside her home studio, which was safe from the fires, Bingham's hand guides a fine tip black marker around a sheet of thick white paper.
I'm using lines to give you the ideas and the impressions of shapes.
Eventually, they form a house with foliage in front. Bingham started doing these drawings 2 days after the fires began. She realized she couldn't afford to donate to all of her friends' recovery funds, so she put out a call on Instagram asking people to send her pictures of their homes, and she'd draw them for free.
And I was thinking, you know, if I get 10, if I get 20, that would be really cool to share these gifts with people.
Photos started pouring in. She's now received over 1,000 requests. There are ranch homes and apartments in Altadena, beach bungalows and mansions in Pacific Palisades, an RV on Pacific Coast Highway. She says she loves capturing the little quirky decorating touches of each place.
One lady had a bucket of flamingos on her porch, and it's one of my favorite details.
Bingham says many requests also came with stories, which she reads off of her spreadsheet.
My partner and I bought our first house in March, and it burned down Wednesday. My dad ran out with his flip-flops, and he doesn't have a picture of his home. House burned down while delivering a new baby.
To keep up with the demand, Bingham has had to recruit a team. 50 illustrators from across the country offered to help, though she's capped it at 8 because that's all she can coordinate. Friends manage the emails, and strangers on Instagram have offered to donate art supplies.
I think I accidentally started a nonprofit.
People have already started to receive their artwork, like Faye Robles, whose friend, Catherine LeBlond, requested the drawing for her. Robles opens the door of the apartment where she's been staying since she evacuated from her rental home in Altadena. LeBlond hands her an 8x10 envelope.
Okay, I'm gonna open it.
Yes, of course. Special delivery.
Robles pulls out the drawing.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
There she is.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Oh, and the little dog bowl.
I know, the little dog bowl.
Robles says that bowl was always in the backyard for her dog, Snake. Robles works in television and had lived in the house she rented in Altadena for 11 years. Two small barbecues, which she used to host cookouts, are also in the drawing.
It represents not just where I lived and my home and all my memories, but the whole community that I loved.
The kind of community, Robles says, where neighbors wave hello and invite you over for coffee. She says she still hasn't been back to see the remains of her home, and that makes Bingham's drawing even more precious.
So it sort of feels like all I kind of have right now of my home. And so it's really special and something I'm going to treasure forever.
Wherever Robles ends up making a home next, she'll find a place to hang this portrait of the one she lost. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson.
This is NPR News.
The first week of the second Trump administration brought changes at the border, pardons, a challenge to birthright citizenship. We'll convene our weekly roundtable next time here and now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, me Martinez. Australia's got a new star and she smells like a dumpster. Meet Putricia, a rare corpse flower that blooms around once a decade and smells like gym socks and garbage. One reporter wrote, quote, "I am sickened, I am in awe." Fans known as Putricians waited in line for hours yesterday at the Royal Sydney Botanic Garden to see, smell, and selfie with her in a greenhouse. And since she can't self-pollinate, her love life literally stinks. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. A shocker this morning at the Australian Open.
Fluffs the volley. After managing mentally and physically, this is a handshake.
It's over.
It's a handshake. Yep. Zverev has moved through to the Australian Open final.
You could hear the shock on the ESPN broadcast. Novak Djokovic, who's won more Grand Slam men's titles than anyone else, quit his semifinal match after losing the first set. Some members of the crowd booed him as he walked off the court, though the majority did cheer him. John Wertheim with Sports Illustrated joins us now. So, John, I mean, what happened with Djokovic?
Djokovic, who is trying to win his 25th major title, which would be a record at age 37, there were some murmurs. You know, he's 37 years old, and time does its march. There were some murmurs he wasn't healthy. Came to this semifinal match and played a very tight first set, lost it, and then walked off the court, retired, and was a strange sight of Novak Djokovic, this towering champion, serenaded by boos. The crowd was not happy, but he has a muscle tear. It's an injury he's had before. Again, he's almost 38 years old. Things happen, and Novak Djokovic will not be winning his 25th major, at least not at this tournament.
Yeah, the closer you get to 40, John, things just happen.
Right?
So now what's going to happen with the men's final?
I guess in as much as there's some good news, we have number one versus number two, the player who Djokovic defeated, who was playing Djokovic when he retired, Alexander Zverev, number two, seeking his first major title, will be playing the defending champion, Jannik Sinner, who beat a young American player, Ben Shelton, today.
Okay, so let's go to the women's singles. So yesterday, American, a 19 seed, Madison Keys, she managed a clutch victory from Iga Świątek. And this weekend, she takes on the top seed, Aryna Sabalenka, who's hoping to get her third Australian Open trophy. John, so what do you expect from this match? I mean, it looks like, you know, it looks like a Goliath versus David, or David Goliath, whichever order you want to put him in.
They hit with comparable power and are comparable physically. But no, I think you're right. Madison Keys will be the underdog. You know, these are tough times globally for incumbents. But the two defending champions, Sinner and Sabalenka, both looked very good. Sabalenka trying to win this for the third straight time. And Madison Keys is this sort of very well-liked veteran American from the Quad Cities, and she is seeking her first major title. So it would be a real sort of late career breakthrough if she were to pull this match off.
So, John, last week we aired a piece about Coco Gauff's new technique that she used at the Australian Open. She was beat in the quarterfinals by a lower-ranked opponent. What did you see? I mean, is it something that you think she's going to try and stick with?
She looked so good for the initial parts of this tournament, and then sort of some of the hitches and the technical glitches, and came back. She had 28 unforced errors, which is an unusually high number just on her forehand. I think, you know, she's such a good player. She will be able to overcome this long term. But I think there are going to be days like this when some of the errors creep back in her game, even with this new technique.
Yeah, that's going to be something I'm going to be following, because it is difficult, right, to all of a sudden change the way you were for a long time and try something new, especially on stages like the Australian Open.
There's a larger metaphor there, but no, you're right. I mean, you have these ingrained. I mean, this is all muscle memory. Also, keep in mind, tennis does not have much of an off season, so it's not as though she can spend 90 days, working.
That's John Wertheim with Sports Illustrated. John, thanks a lot.
As always, thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Trump Melania digital coins confound the crypto industry.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor, announcing the best places to work in 2025 based on anonymous reviews from real employees. See who's hiring at glassdoor.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. First, there is the power of the president, and there is the power of the courts. President Trump has used his first days to try to remake government and society. In some cases, the president will have the powers he assumes. In other cases, coming lawsuits will show he does not. For instance, the ability of federal agencies to carry out administration plans will be shaped by a Supreme Court decision overturning what's called Chevron deference. Let's bring in my colleagues, Kimberly Adams with Sabri Benishour. Sabri?
So Chevron deference was the idea that whenever there is a debate over a regulation, something unclear about it, a court should give deference to the federal agency involved in interpreting it, give the federal agency the benefit of the doubt. Remind us why the Supreme Court rolled that whole thing back.
So opponents of this idea had been complaining for a long time that federal agencies were overreaching in their rules and regulations and effectively doing the work of Congress. And in a series of cases, the Supreme Court agreed. So now when there's a disagreement over some federal agency's policy, the deference is supposed to go to the court's interpretation of whatever law was being used to justify the regulation rather than the agency's interpretation.
Now, this move was celebrated by conservatives at the time, but now it is a conservative administration that's in charge of these agencies. So is this a good thing for the Trump administration?
Potentially. I've talked to several conservative lawyers and economists who see the ruling along with the administration friendly to regulatory rollbacks as a good combination. Devin Watkins is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
We're now looking and trying to decide exactly how much power these agencies have to interpret things. And for interpretations that the agencies have had in the past, how many of those are actually valid?
With the idea that past regulations that may be on shaky ground post-Chevron could get struck down in court. This has come up a lot in the context of the planned Department of Government Efficiency.
This shift in policy, this end to the deference given to a government agency, that could work against the Trump administration, right?
Right. I mean, just like old regulations can be challenged, so can new ones. Neil Chilson is head of AI policy at the Abundance Institute, which is a think tank focused on technology and innovation.
In areas with big rulemaking agencies, and so if you think EPA, Department of Energy, transportation, and telecommunications, those are probably the big spaces where the courts will apply a less deferential approach.
So we may see opponents of new rules and regulations coming out of the Trump White House deploy this tool as well to get a court to limit the reach of what these agencies can do without Congress under Trump.
Marketplace Senior Washington Correspondent Kimberly Adams, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
California lawmakers have approved several billions in state money to respond to the wildfires. President Trump is due to view damage today amid questions about how the administration might put new conditions on federal aid. Marketplace's Nova Safo has details.
Nearly all of the $2.5 billion is destined for the ongoing emergency response in Southern California, including sheltering survivors and debris removal. The funds are a down payment for what's expected to be a far larger final bill. Insured losses alone are estimated in the tens of billions of dollars. The federal government right now is picking up the full tab for the emergency response under a directive from now former President Biden. But eventually, the state will send receipts for reimbursement of rebuilding expenses, and that's when it will need President Trump's cooperation. Trump has made a series of statements criticizing state and local officials, and it's an open question as to how much aid the state will receive down the line. I'm Nova Safa for Marketplace.
The S&P index closed at a record high yesterday, but this morning it's little changed. The Dow is down 105 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq is down 0.1%. The continued strength of the U.S. economy, plus the possible inflation that could come with, say, tariffs, are also contributing to higher interest rates. The average 30-year fixed mortgage is up at 7.12%, rather different from the low 6% we saw last fall.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager. Setting up a new device can be a piece of cake with Bitwarden, designed to secure logins across all accounts and devices. Learn more at bitwarden.com. And by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot. Learn more about Snapshot at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot not available in California or from all agents.
Just before inauguration, President Trump and First Lady Melania released digital coins bearing their names. These have gone up in value by billions, at least on paper, riding the winds of the online vibe. At a time the crypto industry is striving for mainstream legitimacy, these meme coins could bolster the view that crypto is a risky toy. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Ever since the Trumps launched their own meme coins, Bina Ramamurthy at the University of Buffalo says everyone she knows has been coming up to her asking, what is happening? What is this?
A meme coin is like your collector's baseball card or Pokemon card or something like that. So it's a digital version of a collector's item.
You might buy a meme coin because you think it could end up being valuable. But Ryan Rasmussen at the crypto asset manager Bitwise says mostly,
these are items that you buy because you want to participate in the moment rather than buying them to, you know, grow or store your wealth over the long term.
Meme coins are highly volatile, and he says they're not something to buy as an investment the way you might with Bitcoin.
It's really important for people to only play with meme coins with money that they're willing to lose.
When the Trumps launched their own coins just before the inauguration, Rasmussen says some in the crypto industry thought,
this was more taking advantage of the technology to enrich themselves and taking advantage perhaps of those that don't understand the difference between meme coins and Bitcoins.
At the same time, he says the president having his own coin has also brought a lot of attention to crypto and gotten a lot of people to buy it for the first time, which are positives. Ari Redbord at the blockchain intelligence company TRM Labs says he thinks ultimately this will be good for the industry, but
there are some serious players within the crypto ecosystem that would just rather see a focus on a strategic Bitcoin reserve or legal clarity or ensuring that regulators are supportive of innovation in the space,
rather than launching meme coins. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.